This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Severe drought has invaded the Charlotte area, and the area includes much of Mecklenburg, Union, and Catawba counties, along with the recent addition of Gaston, Lincoln, and Cleveland counties. Late last month, Charlotte Water asked for voluntary water conservation, and Duke Energy asked everyone who uses water from area lakes for irrigation to voluntarily limit watering to Tuesdays and Saturdays. Though only about 5% of the state finds itself in severe drought, nearly 60% has fallen into the abnormally dry designation, and Mecklenburg and Gaston counties' drought designation has risen, I believe, from, and there are conflicting stories on this, from stage one to stage two. Now, we've been here before. Several years ago, lake levels fell so low that many boat docks were landlocked, and Duke Energy, which manages the chain of lakes, has been keeping a close eye on its public boating access areas. Two of four ramps at the Buster Boyd access area on Lake Wylie have been closed, along with four other ramps at access areas in York County, South Carolina. So this hour, we take a look at the impact this drought is having on the region and what happens if the drought continues. We're joined by Barry Gullett, director of Charlotte Water and chair of the Catawba Watery Water Management Group and member of the Catawba Watery Drought Management Advisory Group. Thank you for being here this morning. Welcome back.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Daniel Overcash is Region 11 agronomist with North Carolina Agriculture and Consumer Services. Region 11, of course, includes Mecklenburg County. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Jennifer Jabon is a spokesperson with Duke Energy, which, as I mentioned, manages the chain of lakes on the Catawba, including Lakes Norman and Wylie and Mountain Island Lake, from which Charlotte gets much of its drinking water. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate the opportunity.
And Rebecca Cumby is also with us. She's an extension climatologist with the NC State Climate Office, and she joins us by phone from Raleigh. Rebecca, good morning.
Good morning.
So when was the last time this area was in severe drought? When the boat docks were stranded, when you could visibly see that the Catawba River was running almost dry and the lake levels were exceedingly low, when was that?
Well, you know, I've seen reports that said that we were in severe drought in 2013, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember it being that bad.
No.
Our drought of record now is 2007, 2008, that drought. That set new records. It broke. What we thought had been the worst drought was 2002. And actually, there was a lot of work done around the data gathered from the 2002 drought. And then after that work was done, we hit 2007, and it made 2002 look pretty mild. So we're back now. The characteristics that we're seeing of this drought certainly do resemble what we saw in 2007 in the early stages of that one. It was the 2002 drought was more of a chronic drought. It was a cumulative effect of less rainfall. 2007 and now this year, the rainfall has pretty much just stopped. All we're getting are these little afternoon thunderstorms.
Right.
And so the effects have been pretty quick and pretty dramatic.
So, Rebecca Cumby, you're the climatologist here. When you look back at that drought, that 2007 drought, and you look at what's going on today, are there similar weather patterns happening?
Yes, I was looking this morning, and in 2007 we had a pretty dry winter that led into a pretty dry spring, and that year May was very warm, and it was during May when you had not a lot of precipitation, and combined with those warm temperatures and things, plants, agriculture, people starting to use more water, that we really started to see drought impacts emerge. And this year feels a lot like that. We had a very dry May again on the heels of a pretty dry winter and in some parts a dry spring. And we really started to see the drought emerge across the southwestern Piedmont.
You know, I remember thinking during the spring, we're getting a lot of nice rainfall. And you're telling me it was dry.
Yes. So looking at the southwestern part of the state as a whole and then the Charlotte area, just compared to normal, actually every month this year has been below normal except for April. April was actually very wet. It was about 3 inches above normal. But what would happen was we would start to get a little bit concerned about dryness, and then a nice large storm system would move across the state and really just wipe away those concerns.
Now, you're a climatologist, not a meteorologist, and a meteorologist are the people that we see on television telling us what the weather is going to be. What's the difference?
So I look at weather over much longer periods of time. I like to look at temperatures. It was last week warmer than it typically is this time of year. That's a lot more what I focus on.
So you're a broad 30,000 foot person. The big picture, the big picture person. So when you look at periods of drought and when you look at what's going on right now, can we anticipate drought based on weather patterns, temperatures that happen, or high pressure systems that stay put for long periods of time, or the El Nino or El Nina effect out in the West and the Pacific? Can we look at that and say, uh-oh, this is going to cause a drought, or this is going to end the drought?
So we can't 100% say that this is going to cause it or this is going to end it. The same way with looking at a prediction for a very active tropical storm season, we couldn't say that that's going to end any drought. But it does give us lots of guidance. So having a lot of the ridging and high pressure that we've seen this summer, that leads to suppression of convection, which is what our precipitation comes from during the summer, and also leads to warmer temperatures. So seeing that pattern emerge, that kind of that's pretty indicative that we might see drought emerge or intensify.
How often have we experienced drought in North Carolina? Barry just mentioned two or three times. Of course, the big one being 2007. Does this recur on a regular basis?
Yeah. So drought's a part of North Carolina's climate. Just like we have wet spells, we have dry spells, and this is a dry spell. So it's not unusual. It does happen. The more severe droughts, that 2007, that 2008 droughts, that's a little bit more rare. But seeing drought, that's pretty common.
Are droughts occurring more frequently? And if so, or even if not, are they lasting longer than they used to?
I don't really have any numbers to support that. I can't really say one way or the other. I would say that droughts are just going to continue happening. Some forecasts for the future, longer term, suggest that we could see warmer temperatures, and this might lead to more prolonged droughts, though.
So what is our rainfall deficit in the state or in Charlotte or in this region right now?
So let me look up my numbers right here. So I believe right now Charlotte, for the year to date, is 6.91 inches below normal.
How bad is that?
So it's the sixth driest year to date that we've seen, and that's based on 77 years of records at the Charlotte Douglas Airport.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because you say that as of August the 5th, which was last Wednesday, Charlotte has experienced the 18th warmest year to date in 77 years of records, and we are experiencing the sixth driest summer to date and the third warmest summer to date. I guess the question is, this part of climate change?
Yeah, and no single event can be attributed to climate change, and picking out the influence of climate change is very difficult to do. I'd love to do a study after this drought ends to see what the influence could be. But again, it just kind of comes back to we've seen droughts in the past. It looks like we're going to continue to see them in the future, so it's good to just, be ready for them when they come.
I'm not sure who to ask about this, because this is not a climate question. It's not even a rainfall question. It's a question about where we are in terms of how much water we have available to us, because the last time we had a drought, we talked about how lake levels were low, but we also talked about how aquifers and groundwaters were diminishing in their capacity to serve our needs. Where are we right now with that?
Well, actually, that's one of the indicators that the Drought Management Advisory Group uses to determine which stage the Catawba River Basin is in. But before I go there, I want to elaborate just a little bit more on the climate change issue.
Mm-hmm.
When we do long-range water supply planning, it's becoming more and more important that we incorporate the impacts of climate change in that long-term planning. And the Water Supply Master Plan that we finished up about a year ago included that for the first time. And there's not a lot of consensus around the long-term impacts of climate change. But one thing that does seem to be consensus is that the temperature is warming up. And the impact of that is increased evaporation from those 11 lakes on the Catawba chain that supply our water. And so the impact of that is that we're going to have more people who need more water, and when we have these droughts in these warmer temperatures, we're going to see increased evaporation. On a day like today, there's probably 300 million gallons of water that will evaporate from the lakes on the Catawba River. On an annual average basis, there's 200 million gallons a day. Of course, most of it happens when it's hot and dry like it is now. So that's something that we haven't really had to look at before.
Why? You're the climatologist here, Rebecca. Why, if we have all of that water evaporating, why doesn't it fall as rain immediately in our area? Where does it go?
Right. Well, sure. Well, a lot of it could, evaporate and just sort of stay up in the atmosphere until the atmosphere becomes saturated enough and it comes down as rainfall. And that might happen off the coast or as the prevailing winds sort of push that over. So, yeah, it'd be great if it could just, evaporate and come right back down where it is.
Now, we haven't had a lot of tropical storm activity, and we usually get a lot of rain. We benefit, hopefully, usually, from the rain that falls in the Gulf of Mexico from these tropical storms and hurricanes, and sometimes off the Atlantic coast as well. We don't want the wind associated with it and the structural damage associated with it, but none of this has happened this year. Is that why another contributing factor as to why it has been so dry?
Well, typically we see tropical storms. They really start to influence our weather from September through October, that very late summer into early fall time period. Mm-hmm. But typically Charlotte does receive some percentage of its annual rainfall from a tropical system. I think an average is around 6%, but that's going to vary on any given year. So to date this year, that hasn't had a very strong influence. But because forecasts are suggesting that we'll have a very low hurricane season this year, it could have an influence going into the fall.
So I want to go back to my question about the aquifers and the groundwater, because I don't think I got an answer to that question. How bad is it right now? Are our aquifers drying up? Is the groundwater diminished? Our capacity to serve our needs diminished because of the drought?
Well, remember that in this region, aquifers aren't really a significant water supply source directly. Of course, the groundwater helps recharge streams and creeks, and those streams and creeks flow into the lakes where we get our water supply. Unlike the eastern part of the state where they're sitting on these large underground pools of water, we have more fractured rock under our feet, and so there really aren't aquifers in the strictest technical sense of the word.
Okay.
But the levels in the lakes are what impacts our water availability more than anything. Most of the couple of million people that live in the Catawba River Basin depend on surface water, water from one of those lakes or one of the tributaries that flow into those lakes. And those lake levels are down right now, and they're continuing to fall. And that's what we're trying to do, is keep those lakes as full as we can. There's a lot of misconception out there that a lot of the drought supply planning is about how do we pull the lakes down further. And that's actually opposite of what we're trying to do. We're trying to keep the lakes fuller, the lake levels higher, longer, so that we can outlive the drought. One of the Duke Energy folks likes to say, you can't conserve your way out of a drought. All you can do is hope that you can make the water last long enough that it will rain and replenish the lakes.
We're going to talk more about how we do that, because Duke Energy plays the major role, I think, in preserving the water in those lakes, because those lakes are not just recreational devices. They are our reservoirs for drinking water and other things. And we'll also talk about the impact of all this on the farmers in the area, which is severe at the moment. We'll talk about that, and we'll hear the national climate picture, drought picture, and when we come back, Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and DHG, Dixon Hughes Goodman LLP, a CPA and advisory firm with an 80-year history of resources and relationships, headquartered in Charlotte, serving clients in the U.S. and abroad. Details at DHGLLP.com. Well, when he first took office, Governor McCrory noted that North Carolina has a problem with underage drinking and that something had to be done about it. Well, the chairman of the state ABC board, the Alcohol Beverage Control Commission, which is at the heart of alcohol sales in the state, knew he had to get involved. So he and others created the Talk It Out campaign, which launches its second thrust, I think tomorrow or Wednesday. And he and others will join us to talk about underage drinking, the research they put into it, and the work they're doing to prevent it or stop it tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, more than 200,000 migrants and refugees have reached Europe this year. Many are fleeing conflict in the Middle East and North Africa. The latest on the cross-border crisis and proposals to address it.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the drought of where we stand today in North Carolina with Barry Gullett, who's director of Charlotte Water. They used to be called CMUD, in case you're wondering, what's Charlotte Water? That's the utility. It brings you the water and takes it away with when it's dirty, correct?
That's correct.
Charlotte Water, he's the director of that and a member of the Catawba Watery Water Management Group. Daniel Overcash is also with us. We haven't heard from him yet, but we will in this segment. He's the Region 11 agronomist with the North Carolina Agricultural and Consumer Services. Jennifer Jabone is a spokesperson for Duke Energy. They manage the lakes that supply our drinking water and much of our electricity. And Rebecca Cumby is an extension climatologist with NC State University. We're going to talk about the national picture in a second, but Rebecca, it is my understanding that the worst affected areas in this state are in the western part of North Carolina, not so much in the east. So what are you forecasting for the state in the weeks or months to come?
Yeah, so you're correct. It's the western part of the state this time. And looking over the short term, over the next week or so, it looks like things are going to be, we'll see a little bit of rainfall, which will be good, and temperatures will be a little bit on the cooler side. But once we get out past this, it looks like we're going to return to below normal precipitation combined with above normal temperatures for really most of the state. And beyond that, out to your seasonal and longer, not a lot of guidance until we get into the winter.
How confident are you that these predictions are right? Because sometimes, you know, you see these 7 and 10 day weather forecasts on television and they're completely wrong. And meteorologists will tell you it's difficult to tell you if it's raining right now, much less if it's going to rain on Saturday. So you're talking about months out. How confident are you that you're right?
Right. Well, a lot of those longer forecasts are based on a consensus of what's currently happening, sort of assuming that there's going to be some persistence in the atmosphere. If we have a big ridge over us, it might stick around for a while. And then going longer out, your bigger patterns like El Nino, what those influences on our weather, that's really what the guidance is.
Okay.
So when you look at a three-month average, it's kind of saying for those whole 3 months, we're expecting it's going to be a little bit on the drier side of normal.
Well, it goes without saying that North Carolina is just one area of the country experiencing drought. And when it comes to the drought in California and other parts of the West, our drought pales by comparison. But we wanted to get the national picture, and so we've invited Mark Svoboda to be with us for a few minutes. Mark is a climatologist in the monitoring program and the monitoring program area leader for the National Drought Mitigation Center. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Mike.
What is the National Drought Mitigation Center?
Well, yeah, we're a center that's dedicated, entirely to the issue of drought. So where you have other groups that have to wear several hats, we get a focus in on dealing with drought, helping people reduce their risk to future droughts.
So how much of the country is in drought right now, or severe drought?
Well, if we look at the lower 48, we have about a little less than 30% of the country in drought right now, and less than 20% we put in the severe drought category.
Is that unusual to have 30% of the continental United States in drought?
This time of year, that's not totally that unusual. The Southeast in particular, we're looking, again, just 3 months ago, we had less than 1% of the Southeast, which runs from Virginia all the way over to Alabama and down to Florida. Now we have about 24% of that region in drought, so it's really kind of blown up on us here the last 90 days.
But I'm looking at the national map that I think, droughtmonitor.unl.edu, and we have these maps up on our website at wfae.org if you'd like to look at them. Not a lot of Virginia is shaded in any way with regard to drought. It actually begins in northern and northeastern North Carolina with abnormally dry conditions, not quite drought conditions, and then spreads down through the Southeast. we know about this long-lasting drought in the West. We've been hearing about it. We've been watching the fires that are raging throughout California and much of the other parts of the Northwest for months now on television. Put that drought, or put our drought, into some sort of perspective with that drought. We're nowhere close to that, are we?
No, obviously, you know, the West has a more distinct dry season, wet season, and so when they go a wet season or two without the precipitation that they need, they get behind the eight ball, and they're not going to get out of it real quickly during a dry season because that's just not the nature. They're much more reliant on snow, which then melts out and provides them the water they need during the high-demand season. In the Southeast, you have a much more humid climate. You've got water off to your east in the Atlantic and to your southwest in the Gulf of Mexico. And, you know, one of the reasons these droughts have developed, and we have seen some multi-year droughts in the Gulf Coast region not that long ago, if you recall, is because we've had a lack of tropical storm activity, which is a double-edged sword. We don't want the destruction of tropical storms and hurricanes, but we do need the rains to keep this region out of drought.
Why does the West have a dry season? They're sitting, the whole West Coast is sitting on the Pacific Ocean. Why isn't, doesn't the Pacific provide the water that they need on a regular basis?
Well, it's all about the jet stream and where it sits up, you know, during the winter versus the summer and where the precipitation is coming into the country. You know, typically you see the jet stream go well up into Canada and then come right back down across over the Rockies, or it comes in off the southern Pacific across northern Mexico and into the Gulf Coast region. So you have sort of the split flow that leaves a lot of ridging over the west, and you just don't get a lot of thunderstorm activity there, except for the monsoon, of course, in the desert southwest, where they do see sort of two pulses of precipitation during the year.
And if I'm reading the maps correctly, even Alaska and Hawaii are in moderate drought at the moment, moderate to severe in some places, mostly moderate. Is that unusual for Alaska and particularly Hawaii to have drought conditions?
For Alaska, you know, since we've been doing this product for the last 15-plus years, yes, it's pretty unusual. But this is a factor of a really warm winter, because of what the oceans are doing out there, which have been very warm across virtually the entire Pacific Basin and the Indian Ocean. That's what influences the weather, and the same goes for Hawaii. Hawaii, prior to this little drought they're in now, they actually had been in a very long-term drought due to the situation in the Pacific where they just weren't getting the rainfall that they normally get. So believe it or not, these tropical areas can have drought, just like you see the rainforest burning in Brazil, for example, during stronger El Nino events.
So the West did not get the snowpack that it really needed to restock their water supplies this past winter. And you've been talking about the warmer temperatures in the Pacific Ocean. Can we chalk this up to an unfortunate combination of weather-related events, or is this due to climate change?
Well, I think when you look at the last several winters out west in particular, you're right. This has not just been a lack of precipitation. In fact, this year, they actually got some pretty good rains in, say, the Cascade region of Washington, Oregon, maybe not quite as well down in California. But the fact is it came more in the form of rain earlier. It's not in the form of snow, and therefore we call this sort of a snow drought. It's not going to be there to melt out. And sure enough, it was gone 2 months earlier than it would normally be during the summer. Mm-hmm. So this whole pattern of temperatures affecting when does it rain, when does it snow, how late into the season, how high up on the mountain, all of these influences are, you know, one of the concerns we have with regards to dealing with climate change in the future is going to be that hydrologic system and how it's disrupted by these warmer temperatures.
Now, you mentioned, I think, El Nino. We've talked a little bit just briefly about El Nino. Tell me the difference between those two Pacific Ocean events and which one is we're anticipating affecting our weather next.
Well, they both can have an influence. The one that's going to have an influence next, of course, is El Nino, and that's where we have warmer than normal sea surface temperatures out along the equator in the Pacific Ocean. During La Nina, you would expect those sea surface temperatures are going to be cooler than normal. And what they do is that influences how much moisture and convection is out there over the oceans. That puts moisture up in the atmosphere to be brought in over the jet streams, or the conveyor belt, if you will, into the U.S. So during El Nino, what we're seeing now isn't totally unexpected. You do, in fact, expect sort of a reduction of hurricane tropical storm activity because of a shearing off of these systems out in the Atlantic.
So what let's explain that. What's happening is that as the winds go across west to east, it's actually shearing off the top of the thunderclouds that could form stronger storms like hurricanes?
Exactly. You're basically just cutting off their tops so they can't develop and be as strong and sustain as long. And so they sort of just fizzle out. They don't have the energy. And so that does impact sort of how many opportunities do we have for rain in the southeast. But the good news is hopefully the same reason for why we're in this dry spell now, hopefully will be a reversal of fortune, because typically in the winter you expect a cooler, wetter pattern over the Gulf Coast and Mid-Atlantic. So that's what we're hoping does transpire over the next, days, say, 60 to 90 days.
And what causes El Niños and La Niñas to form? Why do we have those oscillating periods?
Well, you have pressure differences between the eastern and western Pacific. You have oceanic water temperature differences. And this all circulates, just like the atmosphere does. The oceans sort of have a churning conveyor belt of where water moves from west to east or east to west around the globe. And when you have a displacement of that water from where it normally would be, say if you expect warm water to be on the east side and it sloshes over to the west side, that changes where all the storm activity sets up, because warmer oceanic temperatures are fuel for storms, and they also provide moisture up into the atmosphere due to evaporation.
So are we seeing worsening droughts, longer periods of droughts, particularly in the west and the southeast, or is this just normal and we're living through it, and because we have media that talks about it, we hear more about it?
Yeah, I think you're right. People are much more aware of climate and weather in general. You know, it affects our day-to-day lives or our vocations. But certainly long-term droughts, particularly in the West, are not unusual at all. In fact, the paleoclimate, which we look at tree rings to determine sort of how did past climate behave, we've seen these decadal, you know, droughts that can go 10 years, 15 years, or longer. So it's not totally unexpected, and that's a fact not just in the West, but also across other parts of the country.
I have two climatologists on the phone with me right now. You, Mark Svoboda, out in California, and Rebecca Cumby, who's with NC State University. And I've asked questions about climate change and whether these droughts are indicative of climate change, or these weather patterns that are causing these droughts are indicative of climate change. And I have not gotten an affirmative answer from either of you. Should I be surprised by that?
Well, let me say the droughts are a normal part of climate, no matter which phase we're in, whether you're on the fence on that or not. What I will say is, though, I think personally, from the way I've seen droughts behave over the last 20 years, these increasing temperatures, you know, if climate change bears out and we see this trend continue, it's changing the way droughts are behaving in the country. I mean, it's we see them come on much more quickly. You know, with temperatures, they really exacerbate drought. You can have droughts without the heat waves.
Right.
You don't have to have both of them. So under a changing climate, under a warming climate, which I believe is occurring looking at all the data that we look at, I think it will change the characteristic of droughts in the future.
Mark Svoboda is a climatologist with the National Drought Mitigation Center. He joined us very early in the morning out west. Thank you for being with us. I appreciate it, Mark.
Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. We're also here in our studio with Barry Gullett, who's director of Charlotte Water, and Jennifer Jabone, who's the spokesperson for Duke Energy, and Daniel Overcash, who's an agronomist with the North Carolina Agriculture and Consumer Services. Also with us on the phone is Rebecca Cumby, extension climatologist at NC State University. Daniel, as the Region 11 agronomist for the state, what other counties other than Mecklenburg make up Region 11, and how badly are they affected by this drought?
Well, Region 11 runs from Surry County on the Virginia border down 77 to Union County, about a two-county streak through there. And Region 11 has been impacted differently. Some counties seem to keep getting rain. It seems like the worst-stricken counties are Rowan and Mecklenburg and Cabarrus over to Lincoln. They seem to be more impacted by the drought than some of the other counties.
People in Charlotte, because we're fundamentally an urban county, although there are still farms here, worry more about their browning lawns than about growing corn or soybeans. But the farmers are more worried about growing corn and soybeans and other things, and livestock health as well. How bad is this at the moment in comparison to what we've been through in the past, particularly 2007, which was a terrible drought?
Well, I talked to an 86-year-old farmer the other day, and he told me, he said, every 5 years you're going to lose a crop because of weather. And they're prepared mentally and financially for it. They know it's going to come. Like Rebecca said, it's a natural phase. We're going to have a drought in North Carolina because of the drought. And some parts of the Piedmont are more affected. There's total crop loss in some parts of some counties.
Mm. Where it's abnormally dry and not drought yet, they're just struggling. Is that the difference?
That is the difference. You can have drought for short periods of time, and a crop will, if it gets rainfall, will respond and grow back out of it. Still have yield loss, but not a total loss. There are some communities that have received less than 3 inches of rain since the end of April, and you just cannot make a crop through the growing season on 3 inches of rain.
Which crops, what types of livestock at the moment are most affected by this drought?
The corn crop by this time of year is made. It's going to be whatever it's going to be. No amount of rain put on it now can grow it out of it. So the corn crop has been severely affected. Mm-hmm. Like I say, it's a total loss in some areas. The hay crop for livestock producers like beef and dairy producers, they are looking already at a short crop from spring. It had late spring frost, which reduced the quantity of it. And if it doesn't start raining very, very soon, there will be no second cutting.
Wow. And what's the impact of that?
Well, the producers are either going to have to decide to buy in hay, or they're going to have to sell part of their herd so they'll have enough hay to get through the winter.
We haven't talked about peaches, and I know that South Carolina is famous for its peaches, but peaches are grown in North Carolina, particularly western North Carolina as well. What's the peach crop in these two states like this year? I haven't seen the great, big, fat, juicy peaches, but I haven't been to the peach stand yet.
So. Yeah, and I haven't either, and I'm not an expert on peaches, so I'll have to punt on that.
Okay, you're going to punt. Do farmers have the luxury or the equipment or the water available to irrigate their crops?
For the most part, row crops like corn and soybeans, hay for pastures, it's just a matter of economics. They're not profitable to irrigate.
Why not?
It's just a matter of how much it would cost to irrigate versus how much you could sell the crop for.
And the cost to irrigate comes from what? They're not getting their water from Charlotte Water or another municipal supply, are they?
No, they would either have to, here in the Piedmont, have deep, very deep wells or irrigate from ponds, and it would all cost construction of digging ponds, installing the irrigation equipment. It's just not practical.
And, of course, ponds have to be filled, and I read over the weekend that some farmers who do have these ponds for irrigation are concerned that the water in those ponds is not going to last.
It is. Vegetable producers plan for needing water throughout the season, but in certain places those ponds are not big enough. They anticipate some rain through the season, and they've just not been refilled, and they're going dry.
We have a lot of listeners who love to go to farmers markets. What's the impact of this going to be on them quickly?
Probably very little, because, like I say, most vegetable and produce farmers are set up to have irrigation.
Okay. We have to take a break. We're going to come back and talk about Duke Energy and what they do to manage the lakes and the water that we have available to us and what they did in 2007, which was to keep the lake levels as high as possible. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and WTVI-PBS Charlotte, presenting Yanni, World Without Borders, and great performances, Tony Bennett and Lady Gaga, beginning tomorrow. Concert tickets available tomorrow at 8 p.m. on WTVI-PBS Charlotte. Coming up on the Diane Reem Show in about 20 minutes, more than 200,000 migrants and refugees have reached Europe this year. Many are fleeing the conflicts in the Middle East and in North Africa. So Diane Reem and her guests will talk about the latest on the cross-border crisis and proposals to address it. That's coming up at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation about the drought, you can do so. Just email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. That will get you to us. And we are coming right back.
All Things Considered isn't simply a recap of the day's news. We explore different angles of the day's stories with depth and perspective beyond the usual headlines. When you listen, you'll discover something you didn't know, hear a perspective that might surprise you, and learn how it affects the lives of ordinary people around the world. Expect to know more every afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Weekdays from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Rebecca Cumby is with us. She's an extension climatologist with NC State University. Daniel Overcash is an agronomist with the North Carolina Agricultural and Consumer Services. Barry Gullett is director of Charlotte Water. And Jennifer Jabone is a spokesperson for Duke Energy. Let me share a few things that have come in while we've been talking from listeners. Kim on Facebook, we are a small farm 5 miles from downtown Charlotte. This has been a brutal summer for us. Crop failures on watermelon, wax beans, and cantaloupe. It's going to be difficult to even get fall transplants in the ground if this continues. This doesn't surprise you, does it, Daniel?
Not a bit. Not a bit.
Okay. Mary on Facebook says, the only thing I got in the ground were tomatoes and hot banana peppers. None have done well at all. Sarah on Facebook writes this, how come this is the first time I've heard of a drought in the region? I had no idea. The media has been talking about this, hasn't it?
Yes, they have.
Okay, just checking. And Bill and Matthews, this is a question for you. Bill and Matthews, there's a large, it just disappeared from my screen, so now I can't talk about it. So, okay, I'll bring it up when it comes back. Let me talk to you, Jennifer, because I mentioned earlier in the opening that the boat ramps on Lake Wylie particularly have been closed, several of them, not all of them, but nothing so far on Lake Norman. Why would Lake Wylie, which is further down the chain, be lower than Lake Norman?
Duke Energy manages the Catawba-Wateree River as a chain, as you mentioned, and that includes the 11 lakes and 13 hydro stations. And so it is something that it's a delicate balance of how we manage those lake levels, and it's based on several different factors. And so right now, some of our larger reservoirs, such as Lake Norman and Lake Wylie, are seeing decreased levels, and it's just different variability and fluctuations in how we operate. So it may change in the coming days and weeks.
When you do that, when you have to close boat ramps because the water levels are too low, do you warn people who normally put their boats there or use those ramps in some way, or do you just do it and suddenly they realize, oh, I can't use it because it's closed?
We want to make the community aware as soon as we possibly can, but it's something we continue to monitor them on a daily basis. We don't want to have to close them if we don't have to, but it is something we do to ensure safety and protect boat owners' property. So when we make those decisions, it is because the conditions absolutely dictate we must do it. And then we do try to make sure that people are aware as soon as we can.
Is the Catawba River the only thing that feeds Lake Wylie, or are there other South Carolina water bodies of water that feed Lake Wylie, or do you know?
I do not know, and I may defer something to Barry.
Okay, so Lake Wylie does straddle the states. Most of the water in Lake Wylie does come down the Catawba from Lake Norman and Mountain Island Lake, but some of it comes from the South Fork from the west, and there are other tributary streams that help feed it.
When you are dealing with wastewater treatment, and I guess that's part of what Charlotte Water does, right?
That's correct.
When we're in a situation of drought and when lake levels in Lake Wylie are low, what does that do? Because that's where it goes, doesn't it? Doesn't it go downstream? What does that do to your ability to treat wastewater?
Actually, none of Charlotte Water's wastewater treatment plants discharge into Lake Wylie.
Okay.
But they discharge into the Catawba River below Lake Wylie coming in through Sugar Creek. It does have some impact because the quality of the that we're required to treat wastewater to is based on low flow conditions in the stream. It's designed to be protective of the environment and the stream receiving body of water at the lowest flows of record. So it makes things tighter over time. So it does have an impact.
And you have asked Charlotte residents to voluntarily limit water consumption. How are you suggesting we do that?
Well, there are a lot of ways. The easiest way for a lot of people is to reduce their outdoor water usage. If they've been watering their grass, is to cut back. We're asking people who do water their grass, if they feel they must water their grass, to do it no more than two times a week.
And you specified Tuesdays and Saturdays between 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. Why so specific?
Well, that's kind of a controversial topic. A lot of people want to water their grass during the daylight hours when you can see what's going on. You can be out there if you're what's sometimes affectionately called hose draggers who don't have an in-ground system. Getting up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning just doesn't work. But during the day, a lot of the water that you try to put on your lawn actually evaporates. And so if it doesn't evaporate in the air from your sprinkler, it evaporates from the ground and doesn't really get to serve its purpose. So it's a more efficient use of water to do that at a time when it doesn't evaporate.
But why Tuesdays and Saturdays?
We had to pick just a couple of days, okay. and we felt like that gave some variety. If we move into a next stage of drought restrictions, which puts us into a mandatory restriction mode, enforcement is very difficult to do, and having two specific days makes it easier.
And you also are suggesting that people, you're asking people not to wash their cars at home. They can go to a car wash and do it. Why?
A lot of car washes recycle their water, so it's a much more efficient way to wash your car when the water is recycled than it is to let it run down the concrete gutters.
And you're asking people to turn off their fountains. Has the city turned off their fountains yet?
I believe they have. I don't know of any city fountains that are still in operation.
Okay.
And the purpose is evaporation. There's a lot of water loss to evaporation from those types of
uses. At what point would these voluntary requests become mandatory?
They become mandatory if the Drought Management Advisory Group's drought stage index moves to stage two. There's some confusion, I think, out there about what stage are we in, and part of that comes from the fact that there are different agencies who are monitoring and advising the public about drought. The Catawba Watery Drought Management Advisory Group is focused specifically on the Catawba River Basin, which is about 225 miles long, kind of narrow and skinny, but it's really focused on what do we need to do to assure that the lakes on the Catawba are as full as they can be and that they're going to continue to be able to meet as many of the needs of the region as they possibly can, whereas some of the state agencies are looking at it in a broader context and are applying different criteria to set the drought stage that they're using.
So there are five stages of all this, which is five stages of what is known as low inflow protocol, or LIP.
LIP, yes,
LIP,
sir.
Beginning with stage zero and going through stage four, do those also correspond to the drought stages that we're in? Is that what that's all about?
Yes.
Yes. Duke Energy is responsible for managing lake levels, and you work with the Catawba Watery Drought Management Advisory Group. We have been in stage one in Mecklenburg. Have we, in fact, moved to
yes.
stage two?
And Duke Energy is a member of that regional advisory group as
okay.
well, and we declared stage one conditions on July 20th.
Have we moved to stage two? Because I saw conflicting reports over the weekend about whether or not we're in stage two.
From a perspective of the Drought Management Advisory Group and our low-inflow protocol, we are in stage one. And so there are some different organizations and measures out there, and I believe it was the U.S. Drought Monitor.
So when stage one conditions go into effect, what does Duke Energy do differently?
As part of our collective effort with the Drought Management Advisory Group, we all implement different conservation measures. So Duke is calling for the community to be mindful of water, and then we also implement operational adjustments. And that means the hydro stations still operate, but at reduced levels, and that decreases the downstream flows. And we also reduce the hours of recreational releases.
Yeah, so to elaborate just a little bit on that, the reason Duke built the dams was to generate electricity,
mm-hmm.
and the electricity is generated when the water passes through the turbines in the dams. So when we go to stage one, Duke is the first entity to really be impacted by that, and what they do is they reduce the amount of electricity they're generating, which holds more water back in the lakes. So they're taking the first hit, and it's also the biggest water-saving action that can be taken. And so going to and Duke has agreed to be more responsive. In the past, they had, I believe it was a week, to respond when we change drought stages. They have agreed to do that within one day.
Wow.
And the water savings that that generates are really, really significant.
Duke got a lot of kudos during the 2007 drought because of the way they were able to manage the lake, because they did recognize the need to generate electricity, the need, because it's not only just hydropower, you actually use water to cool the generators, or the nuclear generators, right? And for maintaining some degree, the best degree they could, for recreational activity. And because we have to take water from the lakes for drinking water, you have a triple or even quadruple focus here. How do you balance all of that?
It is, as you said, it's a balance, and it's a responsibility we take very seriously, because it does meet the water needs of nearly 2 million residents and also ensuring we have a reliable source of energy. And that's something that, through things like this collaborative effort with the Drought Management Advisory Group, that's a significant change in how we have managed drought in the past, and we found it to be very effective.
Because, as you might imagine, the Catawba Riverkeeper has some things to say about this. Sam Perkins, he's written so much of the conversation has been about the public reducing direct water use, yet Duke Energy is the largest single consumer of water because of cooling water by its own study. Why don't we hear more about conserving energy and see some bubbly commercials about Duke Energy reducing its water consumption? One of the things that Duke has stressed is conserving electricity during the drought. And we've done a show on this, and this was actually surprising to me. I never made the connection, no pun intended. But every time you turn the light switch on, you're using water. Talk about that.
And we've been very proactive in our messaging of asking the community to be mindful of its water use, but to also keep in mind that, yes, saving energy also helps save water, because in power production, it does require a lot of water to operate the facilities. And on the Catawba Watery River, we do have two nuclear stations and two steam stations that rely on the water for cooling. So it is a part of the process. So if the community can turn off the light switch as well as turn off the faucet, that helps limit the impact.
And raise the thermostat.
Yes, increasing the thermostat, consider CFLs or LED light bulbs, keep the blinds closed. There are a lot of other ways you can save energy during this time of year.
Is air conditioning the biggest use of electricity in the summertime in this region?
I would want to check on what the significant use is. From a residential standpoint, it's certainly one of the contributors.
But I guess the point is that when you're using more electricity, the generating stations have to run more frequently or harder or longer or whatever, and that causes more water to be used for cooling purposes or for the turbines to spin for the hydroelectric part of it, correct?
That is correct. It is, water is an integral part of producing energy. So in addition to conserving energy through limited water use, limited electricity use, we also do a lot of things to promote home efficiency. So those all throughout the year can contribute.
Yes, I get your mailers every month about home efficiency telling me how inefficient I am.
Well, Mike, you know, the other thing is there is a really strong connection between water and energy, obviously. And it takes a lot of electricity to generate water. So when you save water, you're saving energy. And when you save energy, you're saving water. So it's very circular.
So what tools are in your toolbox at Duke Energy? You have to rely on the public to reduce their consumption of water and their consumption of electricity in a period of drought. What can you do? What do you do? Do you slow the turbines down? Do you stop using the turbines? What do you do?
We do continue to use the hydro stations during periods of drought, but we do reduce the production level, and that does slow the flow releases, and that helps preserve storage in the lakes. And that's our focus during drought conditions, is to preserve those lake levels.
Hmm. Is it too late, Daniel, for farmers? Given the drought that we've had so far this year, if we got a bunch of rain, which, Rebecca, I'm not sure we're going to get, but we'll talk about that in a second, is it too late to recover?
In certain aspects, in certain crops, yes, it's too late. We will not recover from the corn. Soybeans could be come out of it. Home gardens, mm-hmm. you know, you could have a late garden. And it's all dependable on what the crop is.
Rebecca Cumby, do you see significant enough rainfall that might be helpful to farmers in the near future, particularly in this part of the state?
I'm not seeing that in any forecast. It looks like we're going to continue to see below normal precipitation combined with those warmer temperatures.
You talked about hay cuttings, which, you know, people don't care about because we don't eat hay, but cows do. And we normally have two hay cuttings a year, and the first hay cutting in March was damaged by a March freeze. And now the second hay cutting has been damaged by a lack of water and heat, rising heat. Is this the perfect storm for disaster for farmers?
Well, it this year it is. Next year, it'll probably be better, and that's the way farmers always look at it. They're optimistic.
Eternally optimistic.
They're eternally optimistic, and next year they'll go out and plant because they'll believe next year will be better than this year.
Roger writes, I live in Rowan County, and the small stream in our backyard is bone dry. I've lived here since 2001, have never experienced this condition prior to this year. We live about 10 miles south of Salisbury, just off Old Concord-Salisbury Highway in the Crooked Creek subdivision. The name of the stream, of course, is Crooked Creek. That's a feeder into the Catawba, I would imagine, right?
I believe Crooked Creek drains into the Yadkin.
The Yadkin, okay.
Yes, but they're similar issues.
Bill and Matthews writes, there's a large pipe at Idlewild Road near the intersection with I-485 that has been spewing water for at least the last couple of weeks. I've heard the pipe is used to flush the water system. How is flushing thousands of gallons of water out into the ground a good way to conserve water resources during a drought? Could you also explain to your listeners the best time to water your lawns and gardens if you feel you must do? We've already talked about that. There are still too many people watering during the hottest parts of the day. Finally, a good way to conserve water is to reduce the number of showers and baths taken per household per week. What about that pipe spewing water?
Well, you know, this is a real conundrum because the water quality requirements that we have to meet require that we keep water in the pipes fresh. And we have some long distances that water needs to travel in our system, and we have to keep flushing in certain areas to maintain the water quality standards that we want to and need to maintain. So it's a contradiction, it's a conundrum, but it's a necessary thing.
So we talked a little bit about El Nino having an effect in our weather as we go through the rest of the year here, Rebecca. Tropical storms, even hurricanes, are affected by that. Do you see anything in your crystal ball there that would indicate we're going to get any significant rainfall from tropical storms as we head into the fall?
I don't see anything yet, you know. Yes, as Mark Sabota mentioned earlier, we have reduced chances, but we could still see one. And, you know, all it takes is one storm to have a really big influence. My fingers are, really crossed for the winter when El Nino might bring us some more precipitation.
Well, as long as it's not frozen, I'm with you. Rebecca Cumbie is an extension climatologist with NC State University. Jennifer Jabone is a spokesperson for Duke Energy. Daniel Overcash, Regional 11 agronomist with the North Carolina Agriculture and Consumer Services. And Barry Gullett is the director of Charlotte Water. The other thing you can do is adjust your irrigation system so that the water flowing from it goes onto the ground and not the pavement.
Absolutely.
That includes the city of Charlotte, by the way. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins.